are going to go immediately into our next session. So thank you, Paul. Thank you, Glenn. If I can ask our speakers for the next session to come up. Okay, so we're going to get down to business, and we're going to do so by tackling some media issues. We've invited three distinguished speakers to help us to start exploring some of the current challenges we are facing in what we are terming an uncertain world. The format of this session is as follows. We have asked each of our speakers to speak for 15 to 20 minutes, and then at the end of their presentations, we will open up the mics to the audience for questions and answers. Our first presenter is Dr. David Gruen. Dr. Gruen is the Deputy Secretary, Economic, in the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. He has spent much of his career engaging in economic research and is a dedicated government staff member, having also worked for the Australian Treasury and Reserve Bank of Australia. In your programs, you will have more detailed biographies of our speakers, so we are keeping our biographies short. Dr. Gruen.
Thanks very much, Abigail. And thanks for the opportunity to speak to you. The title of this morning's session is Challenges of an Uncertain World. This is a broad topic that could be taken in many directions. In my remarks today, I've chosen to focus on the implications of the technological advances we see all around us for the future of work. The displacement of jobs by technology, often technology from overseas, is one of the developments that's leading to a sense of unease among many in the community. This unease might be about the possibility that the jobs people are currently doing might be replaced by machines, or on a longer timescale that there will be insufficient meaningful jobs for our children. Fear that technological advance will render many jobs obsolete is an idea with a long pedigree. Probably the best known historical example is the early 19th century Luddite movement, named after Ned Ludd, who may not have existed, apparently, when English textile workers destroyed weaving machines because, having invested time and effort learning the skills of their craft, they feared that it would all go to waste as machines replaced their jobs. Of course, the observation that the Luddites were on the wrong side of history does not automatically imply that a similar argument might not have merit in the modern world. After all, the technological advances we see all around us are far more widespread and sophisticated than those contemplated by Ned Ludd, and are capable of displacing a vastly wider array of human tasks than was possible in earlier waves of technological innovation. Nevertheless, despite the technological disruption we see around us, the Australian labour market has performed well over recent years. This figure shows one measure of this performance. It shows a comparison of employment to population ratios for Australia and the United States since the late 1970s for both the adult population and for those of prime working age. Some of us might quibble about the definition of prime working age, but we'll leave it at that. On both measures, the US employed a larger proportion of its population than did Australia over several decades before the global financial crisis. Since about 2007, however, the opposite has been true, with employment ratios higher in Australia. Both employment ratios continue to be higher in Australia in the most recent data, even though the US unemployment rate is currently more than a percentage point below the Australian unemployment rate. The key lesson I draw from this comparison is that the avoidance of deep recessions improves outcomes in the labour market enormously and over extended periods of time. There's little doubt that significant structural and technological change has occurred in both the Australian and US economies over the past decade. In addition, Australia has experienced the largest sustained rise and then fall in our terms of trade in our history. In the United States, many of those displaced from their jobs during this time, due to either recession, technology, or trade, were unable to find alternative employment, at least over any reasonable time. And this inability to find alternative employment for displaced workers occurred despite the obvious flexibility of the labour market in the United States. By contrast, in Australia, where there was no economic collapse because of the global financial crisis, and where the macroeconomy continued to grow at a reasonable pace in its aftermath, it was possible for those people displaced from their jobs to find alternative employment. While clearly this was not true for everyone displaced from a job, it was true on average and in aggregate. Of course, technological change has affected organised labour markets for as long as organised labour markets have existed. The next figure acts as a reminder that technological change, along with changing patterns of demand, drives large changes in the sectoral pattern of employment over time. But our experience and that of other countries is that provided the pace of technological change is not too rapid, it leads to changes in demand for labour between sectors of the economy at a sufficiently gradual pace that the labour market can absorb them without too much aggregate disruption. At the beginning of the 20th century, around a quarter of the Australian workforce worked in agriculture, compared with less than 3% today. This significant transition has not been associated with any secular rise in the rate of structural employment because of the pace at which it occurred. So let me turn to the current pace of technological change. Perhaps surprisingly, at the aggregate level, there has been no sign in recent years of a quickening in the rate of change of employment shares across occupational categories. No quickening in the rate of change of employment shares across occupational categories. Further, it's hard to find evidence of rapid economy-wide productivity growth. Across the developed world, and including in Australia, both labour and multi-factor productivity have been growing particularly sluggishly for some time. Arguably, this lack of productivity growth could be a measurement problem. Productivity could be rising fast, but our capacity to measure it could have become increasingly degraded. While this is a theoretical possibility, it is as well to recognise that measures of productivity have been subject to measurement issues for as long as they've been generated. Most scholars who've examined the issue carefully argue that measurement issues can explain some of the productivity slowdown, but only a minority of it. An alternative possibility is that the disruptive technological changes we are observing will lead to strong enhancements to productivity, but that these enhancements will take time to manifest themselves. A suggestive analogy is the invention of the electric dynamo, which had minimal impact on economy-wide productivity until factory owners figured out how to reorganise completely their factories to make the most use of electric power rather than steam engines. It'll take us some time to assess the relative merits of these arguments. But what has been clear for some time is that jobs across the economy are not equally susceptible to being displaced by technology and automation. Routine or predictable tasks are more susceptible to displacement than non-routine tasks. This observation applies to both manual and cognitive tasks. And whether manual or cognitive, routine tasks are easier to automate than non-routine ones. We can use occupational data from the Labour Force Survey to characterise jobs across two dimensions, whether they are manual or cognitive, and whether they are routine or non-routine, which leads to four distinct categories of jobs. Examining how the proportion of jobs in these four categories changes over time leads to this figure. Over the 30 years since the mid-1980s, there's been a gradual, though noticeable, decline in the share of routine jobs, both manual and cognitive, and a corresponding rise in non-routine jobs of both kinds. With continued technological change and automation, we should expect a continuation of these trends. How does the advance of technology affect the overall number of jobs in the economy? An insightful way to understand this is as a race between two technological forces. Automation on the one hand, and the creation of useful, new, complex tasks on the other. These are both ongoing dynamic processes. All things equal, automation tends to take jobs away, while acting in the opposite direction, the invention of new complex tasks creates new jobs. In the history of technological advance, at least in the two centuries since Ned Ludd, the second process has broadly kept pace with the first. That is, there have been sufficient useful new complex tasks invented for people to do that there's been no secular rise in technological unemployment over that time. And importantly, with rising levels of education, people have risen to the challenge of mastering these new complex tasks. One of the ways automation and the invention of new complex tasks interact is that tasks that are not eliminated by automation are often complemented by it. Thus, for example, the introduction of word processing eliminated the typing pool, but at the same time facilitated the transformation of the roles of executive assistants towards more complex tasks that were both more valuable for the organisations for which they worked and could not be automated. Importantly, these tasks were also more fulfilling for the people doing them than the alternative of being stuck in a typing pool. Let me digress briefly to discuss a further way in which technological advances have had an indirect impact on the labour market. And that's the impact of technological advances on leisure rather than directly on jobs. Joel Mokia et al. Argue that the increased quality of leisure is one of the underappreciated aspects of technological progress over the past century. At one time, members of an elite class spent much of their time engaged in activities like golf, hunting, or formal dances. Mokia et al. Argue that what makes today different is that there's so much high-quality leisure that can now be accessed at low cost by virtually anyone. The sorts of leisure activities they have in mind are watching drama or sport on a high definition flat-screen TV, attending virtual rock concerts or operas with high-quality sound, networking with friends via social media, or indeed playing video games. A fall in the cost of leisure and a rise in its quality is surely a positive development in general, since it provides direct benefits to individuals. Of course, standard economics leads us to expect these changes in the cost and quality of leisure to generate some substitution from work to leisure in response. One group for which there is good evidence of such substitution away from work and towards leisure is young men. Time use data for the US shows that young men have substituted video gaming and other recreational computer activities for other forms of leisure. Furthermore, US men in their 20s experienced a larger decline in work hours over the past 15 years than either older men or women. Turns out a similar pattern is evident for Australian men in their 20s who've also experienced a larger decline in work hours over the past 15 years than either older men or women. Academic research suggests that these two developments are related, and that a significant part of the decline in work hours by US men in their 20s is a direct result of the lure of video games for these young men. While young men may be enjoying higher quality leisure by playing video games, the rest of us might worry about what this use of their time in early adulthood might mean for their prospects for fulfilling employment later in life. Having gotten the topic of video games off my chest, let me return to the likely future impact of technology on jobs. A critical issue, but one on which there is no agreement, is whether the increasing sophistication of machines will eventually overwhelm the invention of new complex tasks and thereby see machines substitute for all human tasks. On this point, it's worth noting the long history of leading thinkers who have overestimated the potential of new technologies to substitute for human labour and underestimated their potential to complement labour. Let me give two prominent examples. Maynard Keynes warned in 1930 that, quote, "We are being afflicted with a new disease of which some readers may not have heard the name, but of which they will hear a great deal in years to come, namely technological unemployment." 22 years later, Nobel Prize-winning economist Vasily Leontiev speculated that, quote, "Labour will become less and less important. More and more workers will be replaced by machines. I do not see the new industries that can employ everyone who wants a job." It's always easier to identify the jobs that are at risk of being eliminated by technology and automation than to identify the new jobs, job opportunities that will emerge. Before they came into being, it was hard to anticipate that there would be roles in the 21st century for big data scientists, cybersecurity experts, and online reputation managers, to name just a few examples. David Auter provides a nice characterization of those tasks that are particularly hard to automate. These are tasks, quote, "that people understand tacitly and accomplish effortlessly, but for which neither computer programmers nor anyone else can enunciate the explicit rules or procedures. Tasks that have proved most vexing to automate are those demanding flexibility, judgment and common sense, skills that we understand only tacitly. Auto might well have added to this list tasks that rely heavily on interpersonal skills. It's also worth noting that these attributes that make automation difficult, flexibility, judgment, interpersonal skills, are attributes that most clearly distinguish humans from other species. While the predictions of widespread technological unemployment have turned out to be wrong, at least thus far, there have been distributional consequences of the automation of routine tasks. Many advanced countries, including Australia, have seen significant job polarisation. The simultaneous growth of high education, high wage, and low education, low wage jobs at the expense of middle education, middle wage jobs. Advanced countries have also seen a fall in the share of national income accruing to labour as opposed to capital. Part of the growth of low education, low wage jobs results from rising demand for labour intensive services that seem a long way from being automated, like health, aged, and disability care, personal trainers and house cleaners. Some of the increased demand for these services is driven by rising living standards, whose ultimate source is the technological advances we have been discussing. It's impossible to know whether continued technological advance will see a continuation of these trends or their reversal. But anything that leads to changes in the distribution of income across groups in society, especially if they are long-lived changes, is likely to generate a wider societal response to those changes. Further, we should not ignore the costs borne by those displaced by technology. In contrast to earlier eras of job displacement by technological change, such as the original Industrial Revolution, in the modern world, public policy has a role to play, helping people adjust and spreading the benefits of new technology more widely across the community. In a recent speech motivated by the election of President Trump, as well as the general laissez-faire approach of US public policy, the former chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, had this to say, and I quote, "It's clear in retrospect that a great deal more could have been done, for example, to expand job training and retraining opportunities, especially for the less educated, to provide transition assistance for displaced workers, including support for internal migration, to mitigate residential and educational segregation and increase the access of those left behind to employment and educational opportunities, to promote community redevelopment through grants, infrastructure construction and other means, and to address serious social ills through additional programs, criminal justice reform and the like. Greater efforts along these lines could not have reversed the adverse trends that he described earlier in the speech, but they would have helped." Bernanke's list is motivated by the US experience. Nevertheless, it provides a helpful guide to those public policy interventions that can help support people at risk of being left behind by technological advance, as well as helping to spread the benefits of technological advance more widely across the community. Public policy in Australia takes a much more active role across the dimensions identified by Bernanke than it does in the United States. Time doesn't permit an exhaustive list of Australian policy responses, so I'll limit myself to mentioning three of the more important ones. First, the needs-based funding of schools combined with the Gonski Review on academic excellence in Australian schools. This holds out the promise of major improvement in school teaching of the skills and capabilities that will be needed by the next generation to adapt successfully to the further disruptive technological changes likely to occur through their working lives. Second, the range of programs designed to keep people attached to the labour market. These programs include Job Active for the unemployed, the Youth Jobs Path Program to provide assistance and new skills, including tailored industry-specific training for young people seeking work, and Parents Next for disadvantaged parents to provide support and training to develop their skills and prepare for employment in a way that recognises their role as parents. Most of these programs are targeted at people from disadvantaged backgrounds and groups with lower rates of workforce participation. Third, the range of programs designed to help retrenched workers in disadvantaged regions to connect them with training, job opportunities and other forms of existing support. These are often complemented by substantial financial support from government for regions hit hard when firms that previously employed a sizeable share of the region's population are forced to close down. We have had particular success in regional cities like Geelong, Newcastle and Wollongong, from which we continue to draw lessons. In many cases, corporations also have a role to play, providing support for workers they are planning to retrench. Nevertheless, helping retrenched, disadvantaged and older workers transition to new careers remains a difficult challenge. As policymakers, there's always a role for proper evaluation of programs and adjusting them when they're not working. Public policy interventions like those I have listed improve the prospects the future technological changes will generate economic benefits spread more broadly across the community and help to maintain broad community support for embracing such technological changes rather than the ultimately futile attempt to resist them. Let me sum up. Technological advances over the past 200 years have been the major driving force behind improved standards of living across the globe. Notwithstanding that, there have been recurring fears that technological advances would eliminate so many jobs that insufficient, meaningful jobs would be left for people to do. That fear has turned out to be unfounded, at least thus far. But we shouldn't be complacent. The latest wave of technological change is leading to some significant distributional consequences. Further, we should not ignore the costs borne by those left behind by technological advance. Public policy has an important role to play, helping these people adjust, as well as helping spread technology's benefits more broadly across the community. Among other things, this helps bolster community support for continuing to embrace such technological advances, rather than turning inwards and attempting to resist them. Recent political events across the developed world reinforce the importance of this endeavour. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David. Our second presenter is Mr. Peter Harris, Chair of the Productivity Commission. He has a well-established and long-standing career in Commonwealth and state governments. His leadership and policy roles prior to the Productivity Commission have primarily been in the areas of telecommunications, the environment, primary industry, and transport. Peter.
Thanks, Abby. The organisers met with me a little while back, late last year, to talk about the topics for this conference, and it was the first time since I've been in this job that we couldn't readily find a consensus around what the primary topic for this conference might be. So we noted down the broad consensus that things were in fact so uncertain that uncertainty itself was the topic. Now, my own thought was that by July the fog would lift and the focus would squarely be on, say, fiscal policy, with the budget process struggling with mounting debt and revenue forecasting and that, or perhaps political crisis with the Commonwealth government in power by a single seat, maybe international with Trump-led challenges and the rise of populist sentiment breaking open the European borderless model, or maybe instability in China under pressure from debt and ever-rising local expectations generated from what must be the most astonishing transformation economically in human history. But I was wrong. These were the great uncertainties 12 months ago and 6 months ago, and they still are today, and none dominate, all ready to spring a nasty surprise and derail what little remains of a narrative about governing for a better tomorrow. But nothing really stands out, so it's uncertainty. Paul Kelly's much-respected book on the first Hawke-Keating reform period was titled The End of Certainty, viewed today. I think Paul was a couple of decades too early. Today, indeed, certainty is not just at an end, but like Monty Python's famous Norwegian blue, it has ceased to be, expired and gone to meet its maker. A stiff, bereft of life, it rests in peace, and if it hadn't been nailed to its perch, it would be pushing up the daisies. So we're all over certainty. One of Australia's more powerful regulators once observed to me that regulators are regularly called upon to deliver certainty, but few in business can ever really expect it. And we can add employees to that too, as David was outlining, with higher demands for skills and automation putting an end to concepts like jobs for life. And yet there's also an important upside to uncertainty. Opportunity is usually suppressed if certainty is to be assured, and responding to uncertainty increases demand for innovation. Businesses with powerful regulator protection once could be confident about the future, but today, and generally desirably for all of us as consumers, such bastions against change look increasingly unsafe from digital disruptors. In the reform period marked by Paul's book and on into the 2000s, some sacred cows remained untroubled by national competition policy and a more open international trading environment. The celebrated examples were news agencies and taxis and pharmacists and intellectual property. Today, digital disruption has done for two of these what reformers could not. It's ended certainty and offered an alternative that consumers have made very successful. And viewed from a national perspective, we're better off, although the transition has not been well managed and policymakers constantly appeared out of touch. Denial was the principal mode of transition for years in the case of both taxis and news agencies. Today, it appears that technology is now coming for the last remaining bastions. Should denial again dominate that transition, this will further reduce community confidence in the far-sightedness of policymakers. Now, this morning, I guess the topic says we should be talking about productivity. David mentioned it too, and I'd like to repeat it with a little more emphasis. We should all be talking about productivity because in its most important form, this force that has been primarily responsible for lifting incomes and creating value to share amongst labour and capital for decade after decade since the early stages of the Industrial Revolution appears to be in decay across the developed world. In Australia, some people have recently celebrated the return to productivity, labour productivity, that is, to about average, after a significant period of underperformance. Beneficial as an upturn may be, the celebration is premature. The Australian economy has not returned to its pre-2004 norms when productivity first started its decline. Thus, the leap to conclude that structural reform of markets and public services is unnecessary is, in fact, poorly founded. I'll shortly show why that's the case, but before I do that, I'd like to add the most important caveat, that average will simply prove insufficient to keep national income growth healthy. I define healthy as the trend of income growth that we've all experienced over the past 50 years or so. Now, back when I first came into this job 4 years ago, I made the then dire state of productivity growth, particularly the X factor in productivity, multi-factor productivity, a theme of my early presentations. These are on our website. And so, as not to be considered too alarmist at that time, one scenario I covered was indeed the return of labour productivity to its historical average. And we pointed out then average was never going to be good enough. Well, I think you can see from this most recent of the statistics on national income growth why that is so. Why that is so. So even though labour productivity is up versus the period 2000 to 2012, from 2012 to 16, it's a little higher, but it's insufficient to offset in terms of national income growth. Indeed, in our view, we would need to outperform in this decade if we were not to see a slowdown in income growth. And the reason for it is that we have a lot of negative growth influences to offset our meagre productivity growth. Aside from the influence of the terms of trade, which pretty much is beyond our control but may in fact be more neutral in future, the outlook for income growth is populated by downward turning probabilities. Demographic declines in workforce participation, technology replacing some jobs, literacy and numeracy standards falling for the most part, the end of jobs for life, meaning in particular from a public policy perspective, the loss of training at the firm level that once accompanied them, and perhaps worst of all, sluggish new capital investment. Since the end of the global financial crisis more than 5 years ago now, new fixed capital investment has delivered almost no growth. This despite historically low costs of debt, the return of the exchange rate to traditional levels versus the US dollar, and relatively positive consumer behaviour. Now, we could take a relaxed view of this, and one way to comfort ourselves is to note that as the proportion of GDP, investment's about the same as it was a decade ago, about the same as 2005. But the direction, as you can see from this slide, is down, and we need the direction to be up if we're to rely upon it to support stronger employment growth and shift the demand for labour towards what the Governor of the Reserve Bank sought the other day in higher wage outcomes. With all the direction signs of these important factors being down, the question for those of us interested in uncertainty is this unusual? And the answer is, you bet it is. You bet it is. All these signs being down all at the same time. In the face of this outlook, we need to ensure we're doing all we can to adjust our economic inputs and regulations to offset these forces. Here are a few ideas. We could, for example, restructure the approach to education throughout our working lives to recognise that multiple careers are likely for people in the future and make it simple and cheap to return to education. Literally, a right to return is no bad thing for an uncertain future. Or we could take the serious broom to the accrued debris of decades of unreformed investment-sapping limitations in planning and zoning and urban infrastructure. I suggested how to do this at the last Outlook conference. Maybe we could take a direct approach to a healthier workforce, move away from fee-based responses to disease, and instead redirect that funding towards prevention. We do this now for accident prevention in the workplace, but we don't do it for diabetes or drugs. We could apply a whole-of-government data-based attack on employer expectations of early retirement, along with reframing the age of access to superannuation and pensions. We're living longer, but our working lives have barely increased at all in 40 years. Indexing both of the access ages, pensions and age pension, superannuation and age pension, to future improvements in longevity has an unmistakable ring of logic, and it depoliticises the whole thing. We need to open up the use of data more generally as one of the very few perpetually renewable resources discovered this century. Plus renewing effort at the removal of barriers to efficient resource allocation, eliminating non-tariff barriers entirely within our power, shifting the tax mix to allow greater labour mobility. These would be good starts, but overall we aren't even close to doing any of these things. Shortly the Productivity Commission will complete the first report to the Treasurer in a new series to be repeated every 5 years on how to shift the dial in productivity. This report will not accept as a plan that average rates of productivity growth are good enough. It will analyse, in fact, just how far we can expect productivity growth to retreat in the presence of the factors I've outlined and a passive policy response. The analysis will also recognise the current uncertainty and argue for it to be embraced, because denial is not a policy. The likes of Uber or Alipay, Amazon or Tesla or Google are not threats to incumbent firms because of their algorithms, much though the fear of artificial intelligence is rising. They are threats because they're popular, cheaper and more effective. And giving regulators permission to experiment, something that wasn't done at all well with Uber and taxis, but perhaps is being given better forethought in fintech now, is a genuinely important contribution from governments. Another is getting serious about communication. Too often our leaders from all political persuasions wait and fail to authorise actions in support of effective adaptation. Worse still, they play to the gallery and jam in the wedge. Credibility is a very precious commodity. A stock of it is created by persistently offering simple, clear advice that recognises a policy shift is on and explains why and where the national interest lies. And it's a real pity to see this eroded so often by defaulting instead to offering false hope or railing against the inevitable. This erosion of credibility is not limited to Australia, but we hold up our end. A specific example is the global steel industry. Around the world, wishful sentiment is translating into unrealistic expectations of protection. Now, there's a long history of this industry demanding and receiving significant levels of protection, but two outcomes are now probable. First, for those firms protected, the sudden return to profitability dependent on protection rather than fundamentals makes support exceptionally hard to remove, even when, say, dumping ceases. Second, the punishment of local industries which use steel as an input by leveraging a spike in price to become a permanent increase, and steel is 30 to 60% above long-term average cost in Australia today, is a significant burden. The steel industry is becoming a severe test of the rigour with which Australia approaches inherently manipulable policies like anti-dumping. And the scenario internationally is one where the US and Europe apply what one Australian steel executive reportedly described as anti-dumping on steroids. Now, we're told more US protection is planned and Australia is exempted from it, but that's hardly a relief for the Australian economy as a whole. For East Asian steel producers, often using our iron ore, Significant destabilisation of traditional markets is likely. Supply will chase after less protected locations. With big volumes in play, the international clearing price will fall, and our producers will seek again to be protected from the consequences. This is the contagion that occurs when neo-protectionism is set free. We now face this on a global scale. With the election of President Trump, US trade policy now features a number of explicitly protectionist commitments, some of which have the capacity to trigger serious international economic disruption, including for Australia. So based on the Commission's long history of rigorous advice to the Australian government on trade policy, we commenced work in January on an analysis of the core elements of a new US trade policy. Some may be sanguine about this development. After all, many countries today seek to use trade negotiations simply to advance their export industries, with inattention or even hostility to imports, despite the harm to their economies and population as a whole. Yet even viewed in real politic terms, the new US trade policy is radically different to that which has prevailed for decades. And with so many nations counting the US as a key trading partner, it clearly has global ramifications. We modelled a number of scenarios. The core example are the US imposes tariffs of the order of 35 or 45% on China and Mexico, or the US applies a border adjustment tax, or a tit-for-tat response to protectionist actions results in a global trade war with average tariff increases of 15 percentage points around the world. The results of this analysis were that large tariff increases on Mexico and China do not improve the overall US trade deficit. They stand instead to reduce US growth. The damage to the Chinese economy will be the same order of magnitude in GDP growth terms. The impact on Mexico, however, will be far graver. And for Australia, the impact would be minimal other than the chilling effect of today's topic, uncertainty. What the hell does all this mean? But that's hardly a comfort because uncertainty is rampant already. The border adjustment tax, again, uncertainty is likely the biggest impact on Australia, although some Australian exporters to the US can be expected to vociferously call on the government to seek another special deal should this tax look likely to apply. But the worst case scenario for us is an outbreak of global tariff increases. The modelling suggests a global recession is a genuine potential consequence should the sentiment that drives the new US approach become a global sentiment. China first, Europe first, Russia first, Australia first. It isn't, of course, possible, but the consequences are likely to be ugly for all. If we were to participate in a general raising of tariffs to 15%, and 5% is still not uncommon rate for us, a strong temptation to do so for poorly informed politicians, our estimates show the average household will end up $1,500 per year worse off. In employment terms, we'd have 100,000 fewer jobs, and up to 5% of the Australian capital stock will be mothballed or close in perpetuity. We know this is a model scenario. We know models have weaknesses about the precision of numbers, but what's not debatable in any serious way is the adverse direction of the data. For the Australian government, the advice of the Productivity Commission is clear and specific. Don't participate if it comes to this truly sad space. Instead, recognise and argue that we can demonstrate as a nation the benefits of unilateral reductions in protectionism and a solid commitment to redistribution of income across income cohorts. We have in Australia walked the talk of reform in the past and lifted ourselves from the prospect of being the poor white trash of Asia. We can show to our citizens that getting off the never-ending pathway of protecting this and subsidising that and countervailing anything in between has been extraordinarily beneficial to this nation as a whole. And yes, we can also improve our redistribution policies so that those who face adjustment are supported, particularly if we apply retraining and labour mobility reform, as I mentioned earlier. But this conditional comment does not reduce the clarity of the outcome. Taken over my lifetime, Australia has moved from amongst the world's wealthiest nations to one of the poorest performers in the developed world and back up again. And we should be in no doubt, in considering how to respond to global moves towards protection, that trade matters a great deal to the Australian economy. Our trade intensity is probably 40% of the economy. At the global level, trade is falling. The US Federal Reserve published this last week. It shows the flattening out of global trade. This, one of the primary means of lifting nations out of poverty, and yet benefiting us in the developed world too. And so for Australia, over our reform period, the net result over 25 years looks like this. Unit labour costs fall slowly, encouraging employment, but household incomes rise due to social redistribution policies, eventually exceeding productivity growth and over a sustained period. Still, we can do better than that. And later this year, our five-year productivity review will offer more detail on specific reforms and the engagement with states and territories that will be essential to do that. We need to shift the productivity dial to ensure that incomes can continue to rise in a manner that makes most people more confident rather than less confident about the direction of public policy. Meantime, in a world of uncertainty, we can still be certain of one thing. An open economy benefits Australia, and the temptation to ape poor public policy offshore should be resisted. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter. And our last speaker is Professor Bob Gregory from the Australian National University. Professor Gregory has a range of expertise, including labour economics and public finance. While the bulk of his career has been spent at the ANU, he has taken brief breaks and held positions with the Reserve Bank of Australia and at various U.S. universities. Thank you, Bob.
I suppose it's a good idea to expose one's weaknesses in front of so many friends, and I assume you are friends. And many of you will know this already, and that is that if you give me an invitation to get onto a platform and talk to an audience, I come running very, very fast. And so here I am, and I feel real good about that. But the cost of it was that when I was rung up and said, you know, would you like to appear? I said, yes, no point in hiding this weakness. I said, I'll talk about immigration. And they said, I said, that's a really big issue. And I think immigration's about, policy's about to change. And they said, oh, we've got McDonald looking after that. That sort of implies that McDonald is better than that, than I am. So I said, that's okay. I'll talk about the labour market. And then they said, oh, we've got Gruen talking about that. And so this goes on and on and on and on and on. And so to demonstrate my flexibility in a changing world, I'm going to not talk about those things. But as you can imagine, you know, inevitably they'll creep back. So I basically want to address globalisation and populism, whatever that word is, by making sort of two fairly big comments. The first one is that if you try and relate populism to globalisation and so on, and you look at the US and you look at the UK, then thinking about the causes emanating from the labour market is not really what the story is here. So if you think of, say, globalisation, which is commonly you hear overseas, which is, you know, lots of cheap imports coming out of China, destroying jobs, creating unemployment, that's not really our story. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't have labour market contributions to what's going on. It just means that the trade story is not our story. In fact, for us, the trade story has been a very, very big part. Positive, a plus. The reason being in part is that we went through all the negative parts of the globalisation in the 70s and 80s, and I'll show you that. The second big point I want to make is I think our real problems going forward in trying to handle change lie in the government sector itself. That is, it lies basically in the fiscal policy situation. And the situation there basically is that the incentives and the reality that politicians face are different from what you might want to look at and face if you were looking closely at the economy. And I'm going to illustrate that very dramatically. Let me just give you an example. I will show you that this government's policy and the Treasurer's policy and the government before him, their policy as indicated by their forecasts as to what's going to happen in the economy, is that we will close the budget deficit by increasing personal income tax. We will close the budget deficit by increasing personal income tax, if you take three-year averages, to probably the highest level of the last couple of decades. We will not close the budget deficit by reducing expenditure, government expenditure as a share of GDP. Now, this is really very, very important because no treasurer can get up and begin his statement by saying, we have been very successful, we are on our way to increasing personal income tax. In fact, if you read all the documents in the budget, which I've done in the last couple of months, as one does when one gets old, you sort of turn to frivolous matters. I can't manage video games, so what else can I do? Then you don't hear this story, and I want to show it to you. It's really, really, very, very fast that I will be getting there. And also I'm going to put lots of words up, and that comes in part because I used to talk a lot in Asia where people were not good at English, so I used to write things up. So if I start racing through these slides, you'll know what it's about. Okay, so the first point, which I think I've already said, is that globalisation, as it's commonly talked about overseas, that is, you know, the destruction of jobs and the displacement of people, is not the source of our problems here. And furthermore, overseas, the big contribution, as David pointed out, is not only the growth of trade per globalisation per se, but the GFC. And we really escaped that, right? And it's very important to understand that. And it's very, very dramatic. And I've said this as well, that we're now going to talk about the government. So let me run straight to the first picture. And David used this one, or sort of something like this one. And I like to use this all the time. So those of you who've heard me talk at one of these conferences 10 years ago probably saw the same picture. See the blue line? That's just the fraction of men employed full-time divided by the population of men of 15 to 64. And did you know there was two decades when we lost one quarter of our male full-time jobs? I mean, nobody has really talked about a loss like that in the last decade. So this is a huge loss of male full-time jobs and no bounce back. It's not as though one lost this. Now, this is pre-video game, by the way. So these aren't the kids playing videos. This is largely a result of the fact that during the period of the 70s and 80s, we went through this huge structural change on the manufacturing sector and on imports. So we got rid of footwear, clothing, textiles, white goods, more or less cars, and so on. Right? So that when China emerges today and produces these things cheaply all around the world, we buy them and we don't really get the displacement. The remarkable thing about this picture, looking at the blue line, is how over the last two decades, nothing much has happened. See, the last two decades are sort of the David Gruen story. You know, people are moving around, getting one job, switching it, and so on. Except at the end. The end, you can see it's starting to slip again, right? The green line is just adding the women in who work full-time. And while women have played a part in compensating for the male full-time job loss, that is bringing full-time income home to the family, you still get the same picture. It's a huge loss. So our story is not like what you see in the US and the UK. The second thing, which is important, and I'm now going to reproduce sort of David's pictures, and this is really interesting. See the two yellow circles? This is the same thing, only I've now turned it to total jobs, and it's 16 plus. You see the early blue circle shows you, you know, this is the 75, 76, tariff cuts, big real wage increases, flexible exchange rates, lots of disruption. See the US running ahead. The US is the blue one. We're the orange one. And then the US and us sort of stay much the same. Then we start to move ahead. And here's the GFC. Now, what I want you to do is notice we more or less escaped the GFC here. And the second thing I want you to do is look at the gap and try and figure out roughly what that unemployment rate might be if all those people moved into unemployment in the US relative to us. That's basically a 10 percentage point increase in unemployment in the US relative to us. It's very, very big. Here's the UK one. Same story, roughly 10% relative to us. Here's the unemployment story. Unemployment in the UK and the US is now lower than in Australia. What happened to these 10%? Well, what happened to these 10% is these people have withdrawn in the US and UK somewhere or other. So the lesson from this is that we typically talk about job losses and people on the one hand and unemployment on the other. The mapping between one and the other is nowhere near as clear as it used to be. And that's really quite weird. Because all of a sudden, although we did so well employment-wise, we've not done so well unemployment-wise. And that means that looking ahead, I'm now I don't have much confidence anymore in thinking about what's going to happen to our unemployment rate and what's going to happen to our employment rate. Right? Because these links around the world and here between the employment on one hand and unemployment have been broken. Okay, now I want to move on to, well, the other thing I should say, which is very, very quickly, is this: our ability, the fact that we went through the GFC has really been quite remarkable for Australia. It's not only this labour market employment story that I showed you, but it's also the GDP itself. If you look at our GDP relative to the US and relative to the UK. See, basically, they're sort of trend dominated, the blue line for the US, Australia, the orange line for Australia, UK, and then all of a sudden you get the break, the lift. That's, of course, the rise of China. And to some extent, we should have begun here with China, I think, because China is really the big story for Australia looking ahead. And you saw it in Peter's talk too, you know, the terms of trade. And one of the questions really is, you know, will the relationship between China and us, trade-wise, continue in this direction? Now, because of time running... one more thing is, even though I'm stressing the difference in the labour markets between them and us, and that the labour market trade links are not going to be the dominant influence here, it's not true that we've completely escaped. You know, our labour market is showing some signs, and for this I've just taken the amount of employee compensation for the Australian as a whole, divided it by the population, 15 to 64, and then deflated it by the household expenditure deflator. And you can see rising living standards all the way through, and then all of a sudden a stop. But notice the stop is not the GFC. The stop's more recent, it's about 212. And that stop is something that to be discussed. Now, I want to get on to what I call the looming and obvious tax crisis. And I'm going to skip all this stuff, and I'm going to go straight to the picture. There's sort of three pictures you've got to take away. This is picture number one. And I want you to contrast what I'm telling you compared to the Treasury's, what the Treasury's going to tell you. The Treasury's going to look bad in this comparison because of I'm giving the talk, right? but the reality is the Treasurer is subject to constraints that I'm not subject to, right? And that was one of the stresses I was making to you, that politicians can't always tell you what's going on. So the blue line here is government revenue, which you think of it as tax, over GDP, and the orange line is government expenditure, payments over GDP. And I start in 1970 and I go to 2020. Remember I showed you before this how we went through this big structural change in the labour market, the loss of all those jobs? Well, we paid for those jobs loss, and we paid for it through the welfare system, and we paid for it by the rising taxes. And you can see the big rising taxes and rising expenditures in the 70s and 80s. That's the expansion of welfare, the reaction to the job loss. And then basically more or less constant, except the incomes go up and down. But look at the big gap between the orange and the blue. You see, go to 1990, that's the 91 recession. 91 recession, a huge recession in Australia. Very, very big. Lots of fall of taxes, lots of increasing expenditure. You come to the GFC, a huge change in expenditure relative to income. It looks like a major recession. It looks exactly like 1991. But I already showed you that we escaped. So here's the first puzzle to think about. How come the government got itself into a situation that looks like 1991, a major recession, when we didn't have a major recession? That is a really interesting issue, and that comes basically out of more or less the boom conditions in Australia pre-global recession, global GFC. Because in that period, we were swimming in tax revenue. And Peter Costello began cutting taxes in various ways. And when he cut taxes early in the period, the 2000, they bounced back again. But all of a sudden, he cut taxes in a really big step, personal income taxes, just before the GFC. So that big fall in tax revenue is a government decision, basically, not a GFC decision. And so government now has to claw it back. So that's the first point. The second point is that since the GFC, and maybe for a year or two after, the rhetoric starts that what governments are going to do is balance the budget by controlling expenditure. If you look at the orange line, government has been very successful at controlling expenditure. It hasn't gone up. It's not been very successful at reducing expenditures as a fraction of GDP. What's gone up is the tax take. So these numbers, which come from the budget statement, from the back of the budget statements, just writing them all down, and then going into the projection and forecasts of the Treasury, and then going into the projections and the forecasts of the Parliamentary Budget Office, show that the key policy stance of the government, as measured by what has been achieved and as measured by what they are forecasting, is that they will increase taxes to remove the deficit. You read the statements in the budget speech, you'll hardly ever find that. You'll find all the emphasis on expenditure. So it's really, we're really in a world where there's going to be very big rises in taxes, and they're still coming. The blue line is where we are now. You see, the increase in taxes looking ahead is roughly equal to the increase of taxes we've had to date. So as a rule of thumb, you say to yourself, if this world comes about, 100% of this deficit will be closed by rising income, by rising taxes. Now, if you put on top of that any increased recession around the corner or any increased stress and strain with more unemployment, it's going to make this really hard. The other problem is that what it's going to mean is to achieve this increase in taxes, government's going to have to be very, very reluctant to give taxes away. And yet, treasurers keep talking about cutting company taxes. They keep talking about cutting taxes. And yet, the whole projection period is we won't do that. If they start cutting taxes, then this will not be achieved. So the next question really is, just sipping through all these things, which taxes? I want to spend a little time. How much time ago? Five, at least? Three. Okay. So here, if you look at this, the orange is the company taxes. See company taxes rising. Up to the GFC, they fall. The forecast ahead is we want to cut company taxes, so they get removed as a contributor to the income. The grey line is indirect taxes, GST. It turns out that all the increased taxing capacity that we got from the GST, we gave away by reducing other indirect taxes. The whole increase in taxes is going to come about by personal income tax increases. Now, personal income tax increases are really neat, right? Because if you decide to make all your tax increases come from personal income taxes, you never have to announce that. You can always focus on tax reductions and never talk about this because you don't have to do anything to increase personal income tax. What increases personal income tax is bracket creep. So as long as the average nominal wage keeps growing, the income tax will keep growing. Now, this picture then shows you, again, quickly, the tax shares. The red line is the personal income tax, the orange line is the company tax, and the green tax is the GST, indirect taxes, all relative to 2000. But the bottom line is that a government looking ahead, if it achieves these forecasts, is a government, whichever persuasion, which is going to involve substantial increases in personal income tax. And these substantial increases are going to come about through indexation. The big pressure on the government is twofold. One, how do I meet extra demands that are going to be placed on me from the expenditure side? And second, how can I avoid giving back some of these tax rises? And my personal view is they're not going to be able to avoid giving back the personal tax rises, or some of them. So this tension is going to be the source of growing populism and growing dissatisfaction in Australia, right? Because the pressure is going to be there not to be able to meet the demands. Now, I'll go back and just finish up on one more brief point, which I'll go back and pick one brief point which I think is really interesting. The government does three things basically when it looks ahead. It forecasts for a couple of years, the Treasury, then it projects for a couple of years, and then it sort of projects right out to 2028. It has a parliamentary budget office that also goes to 2028. Look what happens to the orange line and the blue line in the 20s. Nothing. So then you say to yourself, isn't this weird? How come all of a sudden we're just getting straight lines? And I said to myself, well, what happened to ageing? It was only a conference or two here that we were worrying about ageing. Ageing should have that orange line going up, surely. And so there's no ageing, but they didn't take account of ageing. So what have they done? What they have done is they have within budgets changes which, you know, you must wonder whether they'll come about. In the ageing thing, for example, one of the reasons why ageing does not become a problem is that large numbers of pensioners switch from full pensions to part pensions. And then you have to ask the question, do you think that's going to happen in the future? Now, it's true that super will rise a bit, but you've got to ask that question. So one of the things I think we need to do is, one, we've got to make sure that we get this sort of data out into the public and talked about. And it's really hard for the politicians to do that, unless you're in opposition, of course. If you're in opposition, you can claim that this is all this government and you will do different. But one of the things that's noticeable is the broad picture doesn't really switch much between the governments. So I think we've got to strengthen our institutions. And the institution I'm thinking about essentially is the Parliamentary Budget Office. Because I looked at these lines and then I looked at what the Parliamentary Budget Office was doing, and basically they're not doing much. They're essentially just projecting by demographic changes. I want them to go into more of the detail and the choices. So I want an expanded role of that institution. And I think that because it's a little bit further removed from the Treasurer and further removed from politicians, responsible politicians for portfolios, maybe that's a way we can go and get more of this stuff on. So then we can live in a world which seems to me to be a sensible one, where politicians try to get as close to, quote, the truth as they can, subject to political constraint. But there's some other group which has less political constraint out there, which the politicians and the rest of us can look at. So to quickly sum up, I think our globalism problem is not about trade. It's about whether China can keep growing. It's not about the import side. It's not really about the immigration side. It's really about the growth of China on the one hand through the terms of trade that Peter talked about, and the government's ability to cope with this problem and sell to people the fact that we're going to have to pay higher taxes according to their projections. And try and stop the rhetoric about tax cuts around the corner. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. While we're going to have a few roving mics going around, so while you're formulating your questions, I'm going to get to start with the first question. So first of all three of you gave very meaty and interesting discussions, raised lots of issues. So part of my job is to say, how do I actually make sense of all three of them? So I'm going to focus first on all of you talked somewhat about employment productivity and how we think about that. And you all also talked about the, David, you talked about the future of work and how the changes are going on around industry. Peter, you talked about, you know, lots of people have multiple careers, so there should be a right to return to education. And Bob, you started to raise the issue of what happened to aging. So what I want to do is I want to link employment to aging. So in all of your talks, when you think about concerns we might have about employment rates, productivity, do you expect there to be differential effects based on our demographics or different age cohorts? So should we think about middle age or older members of society needing to worry more about issues around future to work than younger people? So I'm going to let each of you kind of respond to that in your own way, given your own presentation. Whoever wants to start first.
One of the problems with starting with me is not only am I going blind, I'm going deaf, so I tend to answer maybe a slightly different question. I mean, I want to make 2 points about aging. I want to make two points about aging. The first one was raised by David Gruen, in a way, and that is that when you look at what's going on in the labour force, it is surprising how much employment is growing amongst the 55 to 65s. Men who were withdrawing from the labour force for a couple of decades have sort of started to hang on a little bit, and women are coming in a bit. So there is a growth of that older age group. But it's not big enough to make a huge difference to the budget implications, in my view, because it's largely being offset by reductions in employment amongst the young. Now, why that actually is mapping that way, why the young are actually mapping the declines and the older going up, why that is, I don't quite know. The second thing I want to talk about very, very quickly, which I think is going to be a source of stress, is as we've increased the pension age from 65 to 70, what you find is the major impact of that is not increased employment between 65 and 70. The major impact of that is a movement from the old age pension to other forms of income support. You'll see that in the Parliamentary Budget Office. People move to disability and they move to New Start. The really interesting thing about New Start is this government's policy and the previous government's policy to try and make sure that unemployed people do not get any of the increases in income coming from productivity gains. What do I mean by that? I mean they basically want to index unemployment benefits and so on the CPI. So that freezes your income level to where it was when that was introduced. In all these forecasts going ahead, 15 years, there is no growth in unemployment benefits in real terms. That means for the group between 65 and 70 who are moving from old age pension, which is growing with productivity, into New Start, we're creating a new pool. So when governments talk about income inequality, my guess is that on average, governments have contributed to that. And the way that's coming about is the lack of indexation of the unemployed. And so parents with kids over six. Now, let me just give you an indication of how big that would be. If we get 1.5% productivity growth over the next decade, that is equivalent, roughly speaking, to cutting New Start by $100 a fortnight relative to living standards today. Relative to living standards then. That if you compare them to, say, an old age pension to getting wage indexation, they will drop back $100. That's very big. So that's my two comments, which sort of grew.
Okay.
Well, I'm not sure I was as heavily labour market oriented as either of David or Bob were. But since Bob lurched towards pensions, can somebody get my presentation back up? There's a slide that I didn't put up, but I had in there to answer or support the claim that I made that we haven't really worked much more in the last 40 years. In fact, it's longer than that, last 60 or 80 years. We haven't worked much more. It goes to this point about working longer, longer hours. If somebody can then run right through the far end, or maybe, look, there's a parrot again. I love the parrot. best bit of this presentation. Keep going. Next slide. There you go. So this is a piece of work that we did in our work on ageing back in 2013, but it's just very interesting to look across the cohorts and see there, from 1901, this is assuming you survived age 15, because all the data is very messed up by obviously childhood deaths in before we had decent public health and that kind of thing. But if you look at the number of years you're in employment over the last century, so I use 40 years because we know in the micro of the data that it's actually very clear cut. But, I'm not sure about the quality of the data going back as last 100 years. But nevertheless, you look at the number of years you're in work. Now, this is not a question of work harder, nor is it a question of you must work more. It goes to this question of saying, if we're out of the labour force for longer and longer periods, somehow we're going to have to be supported. Now, part of that's in education, and per se that's good. Presume you increase your income in the periods you are in employment as a consequence of your education. But nevertheless, you're going to have to be supported while you're in education or in retirement.
It's the whole population.
It is. And I just found it, when this piece of work was done, of all that, I think there were 55 different pieces of analytical information put up in various figures and slides. I found this one just spectacularly interesting. And it's not a moral judgment. So when I've tried to talk about this at other conferences, we've had people go, oh, it's outrageous, you just want us to work harder. And Bob mentioned the transition. Otherwise, if you simply change the age pension rate, people go on to the disability support pension and things like that. So that's true. This is not about any of that. This is not even about the fiscal question. It's merely a question of, in a societal way, how are we supporting ourselves through this? And that's why in my presentation I talked about dissolving the concept, or tried to talk about dissolving the concept of when you must quit work. And in part we have this signal which comes from the access age for the age pension. We have this signal which comes, frankly, from access age to your superannuation. And something positive in a national income sense, this is not actually about, as I said, working hard or high levels of anything. It's just in a national income sense can come from dissolving that concept and adding an extra half a year or a year to your working life says you'll be better able to sustain yourself in retirement. And so I'm a bit with Bob, I don't, and he was saying that the government's got a deliberate plan for this, and I would say it's probably more just, the usual thing that comes up in a budget process. Who's going to deal with shifting the parameters? No one really wants to advocate the big shifts. And so this is in part an argument that says you should look after yourselves a bit more and consider working a bit longer, a bit longer. In my concept of indexation to longevity, it would add, a week, a month, 3 months, 5 months over a sustained period that just says, if we're living longer, let's work a bit longer. Yeah.
Before you take that down, presumably part of that story is that at young ages, people are spending longer in education.
Education is in there.
Right. So this is in the workforce. So to the extent that the generations now spend a few more years in education,
They earn more in their working lives, and therefore they're better off, and that shows up in our living standards and the fact that we can support ourselves through paying money into superannuation. If you think about that, 9.5% is probably represented in there.
Part of the story of those green bars is retirement, but part of it is spending longer in education.
That's right, and I'm not criticising.
No, I'm not saying you are. I'm just clarifying what's in there.
Exactly.
But it's mainly retirement, and I think the intellectual sociological point is the one that was raised by Tim. I think it's Tim Kolbatch, which is that what happened to women?
Yeah, and the answer is men declined. What happened to women? Women went up.
Yep.
Now, the reason why I think it's interestingly sociological is that what this says basically is all that increase of work years by women, and I hope the women are listening to me and they start beating me up afterwards. The fact is that all the increase in work by women has been offset by reduction by men.
Yeah. So just to return to the question, how old-fashioned of me.
I do allow some riffing, so that's okay.
So I think the question was, should we think differently about different age groups? And I think there are a couple of things worth saying there, and that is that I think it is the case that once... it's important for people to get an attachment to the labour market early in their lives because there's evidence that if you don't do that, then you may well spend your whole life not very well attached to the labour market. But the other thing is that middle-aged and older than middle-aged people who get left behind by technology or by a recession do have a lot of trouble re-engaging. And I think that's part of the story that both Bob and I showed, which is that for those countries, whether it's the UK or the US, that had serious recessions, even 10 years later, the labour market hasn't... It leaves a very long shadow, so that plenty of these people just never return to the labour market. So that says it's very important to try and avoid deep recessions, and I think the evidence for that is pretty strong. But it also says that in a situation where technology or trade or other things displace middle-aged and older people from work, there's a lot to be said for being energetic in your attempts to try and reattach those people to the labour market. And I think one of the interesting one of the things that's interesting about that Bernanke quote that I showed was his obvious change of mind. I mean, I think his position, I mean, he's not just a central banker, he's had a whole academic career in economics, so he's been watching this for a long time. And what I sense is a change of heart that if you'd asked him this question 10 or 15 years ago, he was probably quite happy with the idea of having a laissez-faire attitude to the labour market and just relying on the flexibility of the labour market. And what I sense is a change of heart that that's not good enough, and one of the bad things that happens as a consequence of that is you get the sort of huge backlash from all sorts of people who feel left behind and who are attracted to someone like Trump. And so the corollary of, and that then leads to all sorts of further trouble, like the sort of things that Peter was talking about, the sort of policies that somebody like that is going to suggest. So the point being that there really is a role for public policy to reattach people to the labour market and to work pretty hard, not to simply assume that they're going to be fine, but to think carefully about policies to do that. And I think we do that. I think we do that in this country certainly a lot more than other people do. But I think it's an area where we have to work hard to make those policies work as well as they possibly can.
Okay, great. I'd like to open it up to the audience. So I see the first eager hand is in the back, close to where the media.
Yeah, no.
Yep.
Who's going to talk?
It's Ben Potter from the Australian Financial Review. Thanks for your presentations. This one is primarily for Bob because... he talked about the sort of state of mind of lack of investment and so on and the impact of that. And I wonder if people at large are not smarter than we give them credit for in this and see tax rises or tax increases coming down the chute, or at least are uncertain whether they're going to be hit or not, and that's not affecting their consumption behaviour and investment behaviour and all the sorts of things, their savings behaviour, which has become a lot more conscientious in Australia. We used to think we had a savings problem. In the past, now we think we have an investment problem. So do people see the kinds of tax, personal tax increases and other retirement burdens that you're talking about and react accordingly, and is that what we're seeing?
Do you want to answer that one, David? I'm not real good at how people react to tax changes, but I tell you what my intuition is. My intuition is that one, the work incentive effects of rising personal income tax are extremely weak. That's the first point. And I think that's grossly exaggerated. So I don't think a corollary of the rising personal income tax is everybody's going to sort of stop working in some sense. I also think that crossing a threshold in the tax schedule is probably exaggerated, because the way you get the most of the income from lack of indexation is not crossing the threshold, because not that many people cross thresholds. You get it within each bracket, right? Everybody goes up together, and that's the major source. So I think there's a lot of work yet to be done on this. And the third thing is that, just think what I said. Suppose, and what I said is I'm just producing government figures, right? These aren't my figures. If these figures were correct, you think you'd be pushing a lot of research on the effect of personal income tax. You'd be preparing the community for the increases in personal income tax, and so on. And it's sort of starting now, right? Because you've got budget levy taxes, how long we could keep them on for. You've got the Labor Party talking a little bit about the top rates going up. But you would have thought you'd have got much more by now, because what I've described to you has been apparent for at least 3 or 4 or 5 years now.
So I just was going to make a point about Bob's chart and the fact that expenditure is broadly flat as a share of GDP. It's worth making the point that the government has made some commitments that expand the scope of government. So one of those is the NDIS, and the other is a commitment to have a defence spending of 2% of GDP. So in order to have the overall expenditure broadly flat as a percent of GDP, it does imply... the third thing that's having a kind of automatic effect on increasing expenditure is rising health costs and ageing. So in the background, there are things that are pushing up by a significant amount the government spending. So the observation that overall expenditure is broadly flat means there's a lot of restraint in the rest. So it is worth being aware that there are some specific things that... So the NDIS is projected to cost of the order of a percent of GDP within a few years. And the increase in defence spending is quite substantial as well. And the effect of ageing and healthcare are not small either. Yeah. So holding expenditure broadly flat as a share of GDP means quite a lot of restraint elsewhere.
Yeah. And in the spirit of my... That's correct. And in the spirit of my talk, a lot of tension in those areas,
yeah,
you know, which is going to lead to these political backlashes, yeah, we've been, yeah, talking about.
Okay, great. Next question. Mark Wooden.
Mark Wooden, Melbourne Institute. I just want to reflect on some comments David made in his excellent presentation about the relationship between new technology and productivity. You made this comparison between the robots and sort of ladders, and we don't need to go that far back. We're about 40 years into the age of computers. In the early 80s, I was writing essays, you know, new computers going to take our jobs. It seems to me, looking around the room, that everybody here has probably got a device in their pocket, on their lap. Some people are probably carrying two or three on them. It's changed everything we do, you know, changed the quality of our life, no doubt, but it hasn't had any effect on the productivity figures. You suggest maybe, in fact, it seems to be inversely associated with productivity. Maybe it's all those young men playing computer games, not focused on the job when they're at work. But you suggest it's coming, but 40 years, I don't think it is coming. And therefore, I'm not too worried about the age of robots taking our jobs either. It'll change the way we live. But will it change productivity?
So we did get a benefit. So there's the solo paradox, which goes back away. You can see computers everywhere, but in the productivity statistics, I think Solo said that in the late 80s. And then the US did have a productivity spurt, and so did we. And some of that was a consequence of the indirect effect of computers. So I think some of the big improvements in productivity that were quantitatively important were in retail and wholesale trade, and they were associated with much better inventory management, the effect of scanners and all that sort of stuff. So if you're looking over the 40 years, I think there have been significant productivity
enhancing innovations that we have seen in the data. But more recently, it's clear that the productivity growth has been sluggish. It's worth making the point that if you're looking at people's living standards broadly defined, it's not just output that matters, it's also consumer surplus, if you like. And as I said to someone, there's an awful lot of consumer surplus in one of these. There are an awful lot of things that are free now that, that so you used to have to buy a Melways to get around the city. Well, you don't need to do that anymore because it's on your mobile phone. Some people used to buy Encyclopedia Britannica. Well, you don't do that anymore because it's on your phone. There's a series of these things which are not picked up in the GDP statistics because they've become free, and for which there is a lot of consumer benefit without them appearing in the output statistics. So there's quite a bit of that, and I think there's a I think there was a survey done about if you could go back to 25 years, asking people if you go back to 25 years, what's the single thing you'd like to have with you that you have now that you didn't have then? And most people say their phone, which may be a sad reflection on people, I don't know.
Well, yeah, on the contrary, though, there's the Robert Gordon point, is... gee, if you were forced to choose between indoor plumbing and your phone, you might make a different choice. Sure, and we know that indoor plumbing contributed significantly to public health and therefore to people's employability and blah, 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 blah. So there is no doubt a downside to these products. And I'd add as well, too, there is some good analysis on this whole question of whether the fact that things are free now means they're not, because they're not recorded in the GDP statistics, that somehow that's some explanation for this decay in productivity. And the analysis from San Francisco Fed that John Fennell did, and a fellow called, who's a president, John Williams, was out here only a couple of weeks ago, and he came to talk to us about this specifically. It's mismeasurements, and I think David mentioned it in part. It's not an effective excuse here. It's a small contribution, but it's not an effective excuse to the productivity decline. There's just a bigger, uglier question that adds to the uncertainty out there. But as I said in mine, this is the stuff that drives income. So if it's down for whatever gee whiz reason, we're going to have less to share and, more disputes over it.
Lisa Cameron, Professorial Research Fellow at the Melbourne Institute. So this is a question probably primarily to David, but I'm happy for anyone to comment. So having just returned, I just come back from the Women's in Economics Network retreat, which I attended as a mentor for female economists, and I led a session on work-life balance. So I think there's a great demand out there for jobs with fewer hours. And so I'm just wondering, in terms of if you're thinking that, you've got technological change and productivity increases, but maybe you'll see employment decrease overall, then what prospect there is for sharing income or income growth across people by sharing the number of hours worked?
So I would have thought one of the developments of technology has been to enable more people to choose the hours they want to work. So part of the kind of gig economy is people making their own choices about when they want to work. And there's obviously a big rise in part-time employment. And some of those people want to work more hours, but the majority of them are comfortable working the hours that they're already working. So I guess I don't see the issue of people wanting to work part-time. It seems to me there's more flexibility in the way the labour market works now to allow that than there used to be.
There's no doubt about that. In fact, one of the things that's really special about Australia is if you go back, say, 30, 40 years, say back to the labour force 1978, then as a rough rule, the number of part-time jobs has grown by the same amount as the number of full-time jobs. So that at the margin, the economy is evolving part-time exactly the same way as full-time. That's really quite unusual. But there are two things which lie in your in the question which that doesn't go to, and that is that it's still true that if you want to combine two part-time jobs so that they look like each individual has the full-time responsibilities, it were, right? That's hard to do. That is, it is really hard to get, you know, to take the Secretary of the Department of Prime Minister's Cabinet and split it into two part-time jobs, you know. So there's lots of choice about whether you work full-time or part-time, much more flexible than ever before, but seeing your job split into two parts, that's really hard. Now, whether the technology can get to that, as Xavier was suggesting, I actually doubt. So I think much more flexibility in the hours, but there's a cost. There is a cost to part-time job. And so then the question becomes, I think for most people, can you go back and forth? Can you be part-time for a couple of years and then full-time? And I think that's largely determined by societal attitudes. I don't think you lose that much human capital when you go part-time. It just depends on whether people will take you back. And that's just an attitudinal thing, I think.
It's a funny thing, too, when we talk about work-life balance, which is the core of your question. So many people do refer to fewer hours. But if you turn it on its head, in order to have a better work-life balance, I might want to buy a service from somebody else that involves, say, you know, a cleaner cleaning my house, and then I've got more time for my work-life balance. And yet that's a part-time job, and they're considered to be dreadful, apparently, and we should eradicate them all. So there needs to be a bit of, you know, management of both sides of this question about work-life balance. It's not just can I have fewer hours, it's also can I have the hours that are available to me in leisure to be the kind of hours that I really want, and can I buy a service that enables me to do that? And we have a society that does actually allow that. Yet, you know, by comparison with some developed world countries, a lot less exploitative. Not to say hooray for every service that's currently being provided out there as being, you know, adequately protected by the workplace relations system or anything else like that, because we see problems from time to time. But it's very important not to just approach the whole question as being fewer hours. It's also a question of buying services.
I know there were a lot of hands that I couldn't get to, but it is time to wrap up. I would like to give each of our speakers 30 seconds for any last.
I'm fine.
No?
Nope.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much for a great session.